former director of the universe. And I'm here today to tell you what I know, which is nothing much about Alcoholics Anonymous, but to tell you how much I love it. I'm feeling very happy. I just paid off my student loans, and so I'm ready. And you know, it's taken me a while to get to this point, but I just turned 90 years old, and I'm still cooking. So I'll start out by, I'm going to tell you a little bit, and I'm not going to tell you much about what happened because it was boring, but I was an alcoholic. But how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I was a drunk. I mean, I thought I drank, but I wasn't a drunk. I wasn't an alcoholic, I didn't think. But I had a girlfriend who thought I was. And so she told me one time, I wanted to marry her. So she told me one time, I'm not going to marry you unless you go with me to this meeting. And so I didn't know what kind of meeting she was talking about. I thought it would be Chamber of Commerce or something like that. I had no idea what kind of meeting I was going to, but it was pretty evident when she took me down there and I walked in the door. I kind of knew, well, there's something here about alcohol going on, you know. And so I remember sitting down, and the speaker came on, and as I sat there listening to him, he was telling my story. Somebody else had the same experience a little while ago, one of the other speakers. He was telling my story. And I thought I didn't have an ego or anything, but I thought she put him up to it. How would he know all these things? How would he know all these things about me? How would he know how I felt? And that's really what it was. He was talking about how I felt. He didn't talk about what he drank, where he drank, or what, you know, when he drank. He talked about how he felt. And I felt the same way exactly that he was feeling. And as he progressed through his story, when he got to the point that I was in my life at that time, he all of a sudden geared into what it was from that point on. You know, and as I sat there, I began to think, you know what? If I'm an alcoholic, that's my future. What I'm hearing from him is my future. And it scared me. And this is my very first meeting. Didn't even know what an Alcoholic Anonymous meeting was. And I thought, that scares me. If he's an alcoholic, then I am, because of what I heard from him on my very first venture into Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I went out to have him prove that he wasn't. I mean, had him investigated, and it turns out that 2 weeks later, I found out that he was in fact an alcoholic, and that made me one. So I started, you know, I started going to meetings. I got to describe at the time, I was functioning. I was a functioning drunk. I was the type of a guy who would drink, who every day had to be at the Lotus Room in Costa Mesa, California at 5 o'clock because something big was going to happen. Every day had to be there, little beer bar. But I had to be there every day at 5 o'clock because something big was going to happen. Nothing big ever happened. But I always was there at 5. And I got to jump ahead of here a little bit. When I first got in here, I was looking for what is alcoholism? What is it? What makes an alcoholic? I kept looking for that answer and searching around. Finally, one day I heard a guy say, an alcoholic is somebody who cannot with absolute certainty predict when he's going to quit once he starts. And that hit home for me because I could not ever predict with certainty when I was going to stop. I would come into the Lotus Room and I was going to leave it. Just go in there at 5. I was going to leave at 6 to go home to dinner with my family. Maybe. Usually not. And pretty soon it's 9. And I'm calling her, telling her, I got a business meeting here. I can't get home right now. I'll be home as soon as I can. And pretty soon it's 3 in the morning. And I'm maybe driving into the house. Maybe I'm driving to Vegas. A few times I just drove off to Vegas. Never said where I was going. I was just going. You know, I was with the drunks. We were drinking. It's time to drink. So anyway, I started going to these meetings, and I wasn't, and I was married at the time, newly married. And I didn't have any, I wasn't married right then. She married me 2 weeks after I decided I was an alcoholic, and I was well enough to marry 2 weeks later. Sad state for her. I don't know where she is right now, but she was the angel that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was 53 years ago. When she, and so at first, you know, I thought, well, I got to tell you, I'd had no belief whatsoever in a higher power. No belief in God at all. I mean, it was zero. If you started an argument in a bar about God, I was the first guy to jump in, you know, say it's all a bunch of hogwash. And so I began to read the book, and of course God kept popping up, man, everywhere, you know, I got the book, and God kept popping up everywhere in there. But I thought I was smart enough that I could circumvent that. I could get around that. I didn't have to believe that. I could believe all the other stuff that I saw was going on. You know, the Alcoholics Anonymous, I was fascinated by it. I told all my drinking buddies that after I'd go to an AA meeting, I'd go see them, the guys that I drank with, and I'd tell them how much fun it was at these Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Everybody's laughing, having a good time, great time. I said, you guys got to come down there. It's the greatest show in town. You know, and very few of them ever followed me, and I slowly eased away from them, you know, slowly, very slowly. As a matter of fact, I went to one of their parties 10 years after. I was 10 years sober. They kept calling me every year to come to this one guy's birthday party in Newport Beach, and a big, big birthday party he had every year. And so, and I just shut him off, you know, for the first 10 years. And finally, I decided, I'm going to go just to see what it's like. And I remember walking into that party, and I said, okay, I'm here till somebody tells me the same story twice, then I'm out of here. And so anyway, but I learned something at that meeting. These guys were, I learned stuff I did that I didn't know I did. You know, they started in, because I was a blackout drinker, and so I didn't know what I did half the time. I would take a date, go up to Simi Valley, lived in Newport Beach, go to Simi Valley, and all of a sudden that moment would hit. I mean, when I was drinking, a certain moment hit. Where this is it, this is the end of it. You know, you're in trouble now, or you got to get out of here. You got to leave. And I would just leave. And I left somebody there one time in Simi Valley. Just drove off and left her. You know, that was the way I was. I could drink. I always thought that I could just meet that certain point in time where everything was smooth. You know, from the drinking, and I would hit that point. But then I would either continue or I'd already had too many anyway, and I'm off into Never Never Land, and I don't know where I am. I don't know where I am or what I'm doing. I lived in Huntington Beach. I can remember driving drunk one time, and a guy and the cops stopped me, and he says, where do you live? And I said, I live in Huntington Beach. And he looked at me, he said, you mean Huntington Park? Well, I got the message. Yeah, I said, yeah, I mean Huntington Park. You know, I'd never been to Huntington Park in my life. I can't remember even where, I don't know where it is. I don't know, you know, but I was there. That's where I was. I just drove off somewhere. And so, anyway, but I was a functioning drunk. I had a job. I would go to a job, and I had a job in a savings and loan at the time I came in here. And I was still drinking pretty heavily. But it was at the time, it was at a point in time. First of all, the other thing I want to talk about to make you understand, this is long before drugs were available like they are now or have been for a long time. I mean, I did not get into drugs or any of that kind of stuff because it wasn't around. There was nowhere. I couldn't find that. I'd have to go down to Santa Ana, down behind a barn somewhere to buy that kind of stuff. You know, but had it been there, had it been available, I'd have been right in it. I'd have been taking that stuff just like everybody else. But I was strictly a drunk. You got to put it on the plane where I was just an alcoholic. Nothing, I didn't take any of the, one time I took a marijuana cigarette, it made my drink taste sweet. That was the last time I took one of those. You know, that just wasn't my kind of deal. So anyway, I'm going to these meetings with this new wife, and we look good on the outside. We looked really good. We'd go in the meetings and we'd stay, and then we'd leave. And pretty soon, somebody in that meeting invited us to go to an ice cream social at their house after the meeting. And the meetings in those days started at 8:30, and they got out at 10. You know, I mean, then you're still going home and having ice cream at somebody's party. I mean, that was just the way it was. But I got started to get to know these guys. And so the idea of getting a sponsor came up. And I had this little piddly-ass business going at the time. And I thought, well, and I had hired some of them. And so I said, well, I pick one of those guys to be my sponsor because I'm their boss. You know, that was my thinking. That was my thinking. But all of a sudden, right around when I was 6 months sober, I went to a meeting, and my wife was with me. I didn't say I was six. I think I had 6 months sobriety at the time. And we're sitting next to this guy, and he says something about, she says to him, it's his 6 month birthday. And he goes, oh, really? No kidding. And he said, what does his sponsor think about that? And she said, well, he didn't have a sponsor. You know, she broke my chops right then and there. You know, he didn't have a sponsor. So, but I looked at this guy, and I'll describe him. He weighed about 400 pounds, and he had one eye that went that way, and one eye that went that way, and he was an ex-Chicago mobster, and he was just exactly what I needed and wanted, because I wanted somebody that was mean and tough and going to be tough on me, because I really knew that if I got somebody that worked for me, then I could get away with anything. So, anyway, now I didn't get him right away, and I'm also, one of the things that I love to do is I love horse races. I'm a horse race guy. And so one day I decided I'd been really good. I must have had 3 or 4 months sober, something like that. And I deserved a trip to the track. I deserved it. And so I go out there by myself in Hollywood Park, and I'm looking around, and I see this same guy over by the bar, and I know he's going to drink. I know he's going to drink. I'm looking around pillars, watching him. You know, waiting for the drink. I'm waiting for him to take that drink. Because once he takes that drink, I'm done. I don't believe you guys don't drink sometimes. I know you'd sneak a drink here and there. You know, that's what my thought process was. And I was watching him, and had he taken a drink that day from that bar, I'd be dead now. You know, because that would have just said, see, you were right. You know, go for it. Because I was, you know, flirting with it. I was flirting with doing something more and worse. So anyway, then it popped up that I had to go to Long Beach to meet somebody that I put together a deal that was the biggest deal I'd ever done at that time. And I had to meet this guy. I didn't know him. Never had met him. And I had to go to Long Beach to meet him. And we were going to discuss my fee and whatever. And so it was important to me that he liked me. So anyway, I drive down, I meet him at his place, and he said, let's go to lunch. So off we go, and we go into this bar. It's smelly, dark, dingy. Just some of the bars that I used to drink in all the time. And everybody knew him. Hey, Don, how you doing, Don? I'm going, oh, Jesus, I don't know. Here, I'm really in trouble here. And so we sit down to drink, and the gal comes over, and she says, what'll you have? And I don't remember what he ordered. But she looked at me, and I just said, scotch and water, just like that. Now, you know, all of a sudden, that I now believe was a higher power, had him go to the bathroom. He went to the bathroom, and I'm sitting there with the scotch and water sitting in front of me in my hand. It's in my hand. It's this close. And one side of my brain said, you're in Long Beach now. Those guys in Newport not going to know anything about this. And besides, you're 4 months sober. You know a lot about this. You could probably take one drink. You could probably have one. That was the thought process. It went on one side of the head. The other side said, they're not going to know about it in Newport, but you're going to know about it. And some reason, somehow, some way, thank God, I know now, that side won out, and I did not drink that day. But I want to tell you something. That was over 50 years ago, and I can still feel that glass in my hand. I can still feel it sitting there. And you know, it's so amazing, because I know had I taken that drink, it was all over. I was all done. So anyway, ultimately, I get this guy that I was telling you about to be my sponsor, and he says, well, we're going to go through the steps. The first thing he said was, as we started going through that, he said, well, tell me what your resentments are. And I said, I don't have any resentments, really. And he started quizzing me on a few things. And if all of a sudden he brought out the fact that if I didn't like something, I mean, if you were my friend and you liked something, I would dislike it. That was my way of beating you off, and a way of the resentment would come out. Now, it was all my buddies were L.A. Ram lovers, every one of them. So I became a L.A. Ram hater. And so, you know, then they said right away, said, well, you've got to pick a team. And I said, okay, Minnesota Vikings. They had a really good team then, you know. And I'd never been to Minnesota in my life. But they became my team, the Minnesota Vikings, the Purple People Eaters. And so finally the day came for the game between the L.A. Rams and the Minnesota Vikings, and there's 18 of us going, and there are 17 of them are Ram lovers. And so I get all decked out. You know, I've got this outfit on that's got Pray Deacon Pray, Blow Gabriel Blow, all these anti-Ram things are printed all over me, a big, tall, pointy hat, and, purple shoes, purple pants, everything. We go up to the Coliseum. And across from the Coliseum is a place called Julie's at the time. And I don't know if anybody knows where Julie's is, but Julie's was pretty famous then. It was a restaurant and a bar, but it was across the street from the Coliseum, and that's where everybody went. And SC was there, but the Coliseum, that's where everybody went to drink. And it had a swimming pool in the center of it. And the swimming pool was not meant to swim in. So anyway, we walk in there before we go to the Coliseum, and I'm already wasted, totally out of my mind, and these guys are giving me hell, pumping away at me, and we get over to the game, and the opening play of the game, Minnesota guy runs it almost for a touchdown, and I'm standing up, jumping up and down with all this crap on me, and all of a sudden, you know, eggs and tomatoes and all this stuff. I couldn't believe all this stuff that was coming at me and all these guys from everybody around there. And I thought, oh, my God, yeah, I didn't think anything. I thought, what the hell was that? And so finally the game is over. We go back to Julie's. And so we get back to Julie's, and I'm really wasted now. And we're walking around, and my name, they used to call me Willie. That was my name, Willie. And I hear this chant, Willie in the pool. Willie in the pool. And so, I mean, I knew what was coming. You know, I know I'm not a dummy. And so I got a martini like this in my hand, and I see them coming to get me, and they pick me up. And so I make sure the drink didn't spill. You know, I was holding it this way, and then, pew, into this pool. And there's tons of people in there, and they're all crowded around, and everybody's screaming and yelling. And then Julie's coming over there and yelling, get him out of there. And she's got all these guys. They're trying to hog tie me. And so in the meantime, what I didn't say when I put these clothes on was underneath in my underwear, just in case the Rams won, I had some pro-Ram things, you know, so that I'd be one of the good guys. And so all of a sudden I'm in this pool, and I decided this is time to show people, you know, here I am, you know. So I start taking everything off in this swimming pool to show them that I'm really, really down deep, probably a Ram lover. And anyway, they're yelling and screaming, and I can remember being dragged up over the edge of the pool. And that day in Huntington Beach, a father had told his 12-year-old son that he had taken him to the Ram game. And he told him that he could bring a friend. And I had a 12-year-old son. And as they dragged me up over the edge of the pool, I was looking at the back. I could see the back. It wasn't as back as that far to that wall, but it was back pretty far. I was looking into the eyes of my son. And what his eyes told me was, please don't acknowledge me. Do not acknowledge me. I mean, you know, this slob of father being dragged up over the thing. And so, you know, nothing at that time was said about it, except that many, many, many years later, and I'm going to get into that story a little bit about that same child, Many, many years later, he came to a talk that I was in. He's not an alcoholic. None of my children, four children, none of them alcoholic. I told that story. And a whole bunch of people went up to him afterwards and said, "Do you remember that? Do you remember that?" Because now he's in his late 20s or whatever, and that was when he was 12. He remembered. He just said, "I remember." See, they don't forget the degradation we put them through, you know, kids. They just don't, you know, they don't forget it. They remember. So he remembered, and now I'm going to go in this part of the story. I'd like to get it out of the way before I go on very far. That son was my oldest son. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous now, and this is later on in his 20s. And he wasn't doing what I thought he should do. He wasn't going to the school I wanted him to go to. He wasn't going to doing anything that I wanted him to do. And I was pissing and moaning about it to my sponsor. And he just said, you know, I said, "Well, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't want to work for me. He's just working for recreation. All he wants to do is recreation stuff." And so I kept moaning about it. And finally, the sponsor got a hold of me one day and said, "You leave him alone. You let him be. You let him be what he wants to be. He's going to be what he wants to be, not what you want him to be. Just leave him alone." So I said, "Okay." I tried to, you know, I left him alone, and pretty soon I heard from one of my friends, "Hey, I saw your kid doing this Huntington Beach Lagoon Newport Beach basketball game. He was the referee." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah, and he ran down the court just like you run down the court." I don't know how the hell they knew how I ran down the court. I never ran down the court in front of these guys. And then a little more time went on, and I knew he was doing something in basketball all around in Orange County. And pretty soon they said, "Yeah, we saw him doing the Irvine, whatever that is, playing Las Vegas, Nevada, in basketball." And he said he was a referee. So I said, "Well, that's cool. You know, he's doing cool." And so then finally one day he called me up and he said, "Dad, the NBA is going from two referees a game to three in each game." And he said, "They've invited me to a tryout in Philadelphia." He was 28 then. "They invited me to a tryout in Philadelphia." And I thought, well, I felt like saying, "You're probably smoking, your kid," but, you know, I didn't say that. Thank God I didn't say anything like that. A few days later, he called me up and he said, "They have made me an NBA referee." And, you know, what happened was, from that moment on, my life changed and his life changed. He became such a really unbelievable referee. And he was doing games all over the world, but I mean, particularly with the NBA. And he began to tell me the stories of it. And he was the youngest guy they had ever picked, but he had this stature. He was about 6'4", and he was just what I think the NBA wanted. Well, anyway, they got what they wanted, and it was the perfect guy. I had so much fun with that over the next few years. I got to see him in many, many games. There was a championship game finally towards the end. There was a championship game between the Boston Celtics and the LA Lakers at the downtown center, Staples Center, for the World Championship, seventh game. And it was being played on a Thursday, and I came home from my Wednesday night meeting, and there was a phone call from him. He said, "Do you want two tickets?" And I went, "What?" He said, I'd gone to a lot of games with him, but this was the World Championship final game. And he said, "I've got two tickets. If you want them, come up to Will Call." And I said, "Okay." So I brought an AA buddy, and we went up there, and there was a whole big, huge crowd around Will Call, big standing all around here. And I walked up the Will Call deal, and I got the two tickets, and I started walking away, holding them up. And some guy yells out, "You got two tickets?" And I went like this. He said, "I'll give you $4,000 for them," from the audience. And I'm going, well, baby, that's a hell of a deal. You know, but then I started thinking, you know, I couldn't do that. I mean, it's not right. So Anyway, I went in and watched. It was the most fantastic game. The whole second half, the Lakers were behind at the half, and they came back in the second half. Nobody in that place sat down that whole second half. It was absolutely incredible. Incredible, incredible game. But that was just one of the games he did, you know, and I just had so much fun with him on other things. To give you an example, I'm an appraiser, I go into all kinds of people's houses. So I'm in this guy's house one day. He doesn't know me from Adam. Never met me in my life, you know, ever in my life. And I go upstairs in his kid's bedroom. He's got a poster, big, huge poster. And it's Magic Johnson and Kevin Johnson, two black guys fighting for the ball. And right behind him is my kid with the whistle hanging out of his mouth. And he's just sort of muted. And, you know, and I said, you got a picture of my kid. And he said, and so he looks at these two black guys and he looks at me. And I went, no, the guy in the background, the guy. So, anyway, that kind of stuff happened all the time. And, you know, it was just, I had more fun with it. And he was having fun with it. And he told me some stories about that NBA that blow your mind. And the things that they do. See, he lived in Huntington Beach. But the NBA doesn't care where you live. And he lived in Huntington Beach. So they could have a game at Staples Center. They'll fly him to Boston to do a game. You know, it has no bearing on where he lives. And they had to go first class. And one time he told me they had to go first class with a tie and everything, wherever they went, because they're representing the NBA. And so he said, and then the guys decided that they could transfer these tickets from first class to coach. And so they started doing it. And now the NBA really wasn't approval of it, but they didn't really care. Everybody was doing it. And then he told me, he said, yeah, I made $50,000 last year just trading tickets. I went, holy cow, man, what kind of a deal is this? It's really something. And so it turns out that the NBA said that as long as you did what you're supposed to do, which is report it, that you're okay, that the NBA wouldn't do anything about it. Because ultimately, after I said that to him, about 6 or 8 months later, the IRS came walking in and wanted to know, you know, what was going on. And the NBA said, if you didn't do what you're supposed to do, you're out of here. And a bunch of referees left. They were gone. But they went to my kid's house, and he said he was taking his kids to school. He didn't care about these agents because he knew his deal was taken care of. He's that kind of a guy. He'd have written it. I probably wouldn't have. I probably wouldn't have. I said, oh, what the hell? The IRS didn't know about this. Anyway, there was all kinds of things that went on during all that. That was just really fascinating to me, and it was a great time for me to watch all this. And so, and then about 13 years ago, I was at the Palm Springs Roundup, and he was going to do a basketball game the night of this. They're having the banquet, and he was going to be doing a game that night against Boston again in Boston. And so we were watching the screen before we go down to the dinner, and all of a sudden they said that the referee. Something about, they didn't say exactly what happened, but something happened and he wasn't there. So anyway, we had to leave and go to the banquet, which we did. When we came out of the banquet, my son, this younger son who I'll talk about in a little bit, he called me. He lives in Illinois, and he called me. He said, Dad, what's wrong with Greg? He said, last night on the game on TV, they said he was sick. And I said, well, he probably got sick. I don't know, you know. And I said, don't worry about it. And so, but then it all of a sudden dawned on me, the next morning I got up and I thought, I better call his ex-wife, my ex-wife, his mother. And when we first got a divorce, you know, we were not so much friends. Now, after many years, we had become sort of friends. And I called her and I said, what was going on with Greg last night? She said, how'd you find out? And I said, Taylor called me. And there was a long pause. And she said, I didn't want to spoil your AA weekend, but he's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I said, uh-oh. Now, at first, I didn't know what that meant, really. I mean, I didn't know the severity of that. So when I got home, I looked at him. He looked okay to me. And then he started going all over the country for the Pancreatic Cancer Association, giving talks everywhere. And But I could see, and he looked fine. He looked fine for the first 4 or 5 or 6 months. He looked fine. But then all of a sudden, he didn't look so fine. He started looking weaker. And almost to a year later, that was in June when that happened. And in the next April, right at Easter time, Easter was on the last day of the month. And his wife called me and said, he's in his bed, but he's going to come down and have Easter with his kids. And I'd been over there a few days before that. He couldn't walk. He couldn't walk. And I said, well, how is he going to do that? And she said, well, he says he's going to do that. So he came down with his kids and had Easter with them. And he said, or had an Easter night before Easter. And he said, he told them, he says, I'm not going to die on Easter. And then he died the next day after Easter. They called me up and said, you better get over here in the morning. And I went over and held his hand for 9 hours. Toughest day of my life. Toughest time of my life. See, my sponsor had, one of the things the sponsor had told me was, you know, kid, you don't have any problems anymore. You only have challenges. This was way early on when I was working with him. He said, you don't have any problems. You only have challenges. And there's nothing that you can't go through. And I'm thinking, man, I don't know about that, you know, with this. I don't know about that with this. But he had said, he had told me, but he had made me believe that. He said, you change the word problem. Take the word problem out of your vocabulary. I only want you to talk about challenges. Because challenges is all we have. We don't have problems. We have challenges. He said, and if you're an AA and you think you have a challenge, you tell them at a meeting and see how many people already had that challenge. Tell you how to get through it. You know, they're all over the room. In just one room. You know, the challenges are something that we live with. Well, I wasn't real happy about this challenge at all. And I can remember I wanted to curl up in my living room on the floor. I didn't want to go to a meeting. I didn't want to do anything. And right away, knock on the door. Two sponsees that said, we're going to lunch, and then we're going to a meeting. And I went, no, you guys go, I'm not going. He said, you're going. I mean, they just flat-ass told me, you're going. Not only are you going, when we get to that meeting, you're leading the meeting. And I thought, oh, well, thank you, guys, you know, nice guys. But anyway, that's what happened. And what later came out of all that was that I realized, somebody said to me, you know what, when something like that happens, somebody loses somebody, they want somebody to go talk to in AA, whether they lose a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, a friend, or children. Doesn't matter. We all lose somebody if we hang around here long enough. Everybody loses somebody. And they need somebody to talk to about it, because that's the nature of what we do. And so now, 13 years later, I get calls all the time. My son just got killed in a motorcycle wreck. I live through the whole thing again. But I'm trying, I know that I'm helping somebody out and telling them, you know, what you got to do. For me, at least, what I had to do was get really back into AA and start working harder and harder and harder on my program and working harder and harder in my life. And my life has gotten so enjoyable recently. That was 13 years ago, but I still think about that situation, and it was a tough time for me. But I'll go into some other things that happened along the way. After I got a divorce and got into the program, I went to there was a lot of people from Long Beach. I went to the Golden Sales one night. I'm single. And the Golden Sales in Long Beach is, at that time, was some really fancy spot that you go and, you know, wild dancing and everything. So I met my next ex-wife and that night. And you know, she She was the one that, she was the one that kind of got me to get going and everything in AA ultimately. That had happened before that. So anyway, she came into my life, and finally I ended up in San Diego. I remember how I was living in Newport, and I ended up in San Diego for a while. Oh, that was right. And so I saw this gal walk by where I lived, and she had a shirt on that said, "Marry me and fly for free." And I thought, geez, that sounds like a hell of a deal. You know, and so I did. they had this stewardess wife who, I had a little credit card. I could just go down to Delta and first class, wherever you wanted to go, it's like a little credit card. You could just say, "I want to go to Japan." You know, okay, fine, take off. I mean, I thought, oh, wow, this is really wild. She was the next victim, if you want to put it that way, of me. And some other things that happened along the way that had the wife from the Golden Sales was the one that got me to come to AA ultimately. Originally, she was the one that had that happen. This was what happened later. Was this wife from Delta Airlines. And so I had not divorced her yet, but we had separated. Then 10 years or so goes by, and I had not divorced her, but I had moved out. She was living in San Diego, and I was living in Laguna Beach. And so I met my first Alcoholics Anonymous woman, and I was dating her, and all of a sudden one day she says, "I got some news for you." And I said, "What's that?" She says, "I'm pregnant." I was 19 years sober at that time, leading a beautiful program, right? And she says, I'm pregnant. And I looked at her and I said, "What are you going to do about it?" Now, I got to set the picture. I'm 55 years old at that point in time, and my kids are all grown up, the other ones. And so she was 35 years old, and she'd never been pregnant. She'd been sober a year and a half. And I could tell by the look in her eyes, she wasn't going to do nothing about it. So I went to my STAG meeting, you know, where I lay out all my challenges. And I laid them out as I saw them. And the first guy in response said, "Well, I wish I had a sober father like you when I was growing up." And the next guy said, "Well, maybe this is your chance to raise a child in sobriety." And I go, yeah. And the third jackass says, "You'll only be 73 when he graduates from high school." Well, he ended up graduating from high school, but not only that, he ended up being one beautiful, beautiful child when she was pregnant with him, my sponsor got a hold of me and he said, "Listen," he said, "did your parents," he said, "did your parents love you?" And I said, "Well, I don't have any reason to doubt that they did, but they never told me that." And he says, "Well, too many generations have not told their children that they love them." And he says, "What I want you to do is every night when that child is born, every night after he's born, you tell him that you love him. And I don't care how old he is, he's a brand new baby. You tell him that you love him, and you do it every single night." And I thought, okay. And I did. And he grew up be a fascinating kid. He all of a sudden, he blossomed into the point where he was going to be ordained. So he went back to Illinois to be ordained, really. He ended up being he didn't even become a pastor. But I can remember at that point in time, I said to him, "Hey, man, you know, if you're ordained, you got to help me." And he said, no, Pop, you got to do that on your own. You know, that's your deal. And so, you know, he, he, uh, and, and so But I did tell him that I loved him every night. When I was 80 years old, he gave me a two-page letter, single space, that every man wants to get before he dies from his child. Because this letter spelled out our life in detail, in absolute detail, about every point and everything that happened in our life. And he mentions in there about me telling him that I love him every night. And what happened, you know, and what has happened to us, and how, you know, how he'd been to a lot of meetings with me. He came to a lot of meetings as he was growing up. Because there's one whole area that we had a connection in. Just to back up a little bit, when I first got sober, I wasn't even sober. I was just getting there. And the area that we lived in Huntington Beach with the family of three kids, two of the boys, the basketball player and his brother, and my daughter. You know, the Huntington Beach had a meeting one night to form a little league. And it always, you know, that was always my big passion. They were going to form a little league. So I went to the meeting, and I was half drunk when I got there. And so by the time I left there, I was the president of the newly formed Huntington Valley Little League. You know, that was just exactly the last thing they needed, and it was me as their president. And, you know, and I had a team, you know, my team, I began working them. Every single night, didn't matter when, around the clock, I'd be drinking out there, and the parents don't care if you're a drunk as long as you're winning. I mean, that's all they care about. You're going to win the game? And I said, yes, we're going to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, be in the Little League World Series. I mean, that's what we're shooting for, and that's what I was shooting for. I was shooting for that. They weren't. They were just trying to have fun. But anyway, that's the way it went. That's the way it came down, and they did not go to We did not go to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, but a lot of crazy things happened. You know, there was another guy. They formed, there was such a big meeting that they formed two different leagues. And the other area was called Seaview Little League, and then we had Huntington Valley Little League. So the first time I ever walked into that ANAA meeting, here's another, the guy who was the president, was appointed president that night of the Seaview Little League, walking into the meeting. You know, here's two drunks are the presidents of these little leagues in you know, in the same general area. So anyway, ultimately, there came a day when it was going to be the big thing of the year, where we had to meet. You know, the whole league met in a big park, and the mayor was there, and the chief of police, and all these people were going to speak, and I had to speak on behalf of I was going to speak that day on behalf of the Huntington Valley Little League. And of course, they had all the kids out there from all the leagues, all the different kids, all the kids that I worked with and in my team, and then all the, you know, all the rest of them. And so that morning, a guy from Pasadena that I used to drink with and owned a bar up there called me up. He didn't know what that was going on. He said, hey, listen, I'm going to be in Huntington Beach this morning. Well, can you meet me down there? We'll have a drink. And this is before I got sober. And I went, well, no, I can't do that. You know, I've got this big function I have to go to for Little League. And he said, well, you can come down and have just one. You come down and just have one, you know, before the meeting. Before, when time's the meeting? 2:00. Okay, come on down. I thought, well, I could probably get away with that. So I went down there, and we started. All I'm going to tell you is that before that thing was over with, I fell off the dais. I fell off the stage in front of the chief of police, the mayor, everybody else, and all the Little League kids, my own kids, sitting out there. I fell right off that podium, right head first. And of course, there's something else my kids watched. You know, they saw all this happening. You know, so anyway, that really wasn't fun. But anyway, getting back, so Taylor is the younger one that I was talking about a minute ago. He sent me that letter, and then he started having kids. And so a couple years ago, he came out with his son, who was about two or three then, and a new baby. and stayed with my beautiful wife back there. And he came out and stayed with us. And he got me in the backyard where his kid playing with the kids. And he dragged me aside. And he said, "Dad, you see that kid over there?" I said, "Yep." He said, "I tell him I love him every night." You know, and it just hit me when he did that. I just, I can't even believe that. So anyway, now I'm going to go a little bit into, I'm going to get past all the marriages until my higher power finally gave me the one that's going to save the best for last. And she's sitting right back there. And I just want to tell you that I asked her the other day, I said, "Why'd you marry me?" And she says, "Because you're so funny." And I said, I thought you'd say something like, "Well, how, you know, active I am in the boudoir." And she says, "See what I mean? You're ridiculous." Anyway, she's a sweetheart and has made my life so complete in the last 5 or 6. We've been married 5 years. And we've been together 6 years. And she is way more, she's into Al-Anon and AA. She's got 15 years of sobriety. She's everything I ever wanted to be together with. And finally, after all these years, I got it all out of my system, I think. And today I don't know for sure. I mean, you know, those challenges, I wake up with challenges every day. I don't know about you guys, but I wake up every morning with challenges, you know, really, every single morning. I got some challenge on my mind, but I know that it can get solved. I didn't believe it at first. One of the first things that ever, this happened before I had that idea in my mind, but I went to a suit, and then the sponsor told me when I was doing that, he said, "Don't be surprised if things that you think are not good, things that you think are bad that are happening, events, are really the prelude to something fantastic that's going to happen down the road that you don't know anything about yet. And this is what has to happen first." He made that point really clear that I had to look at it that way because I would wake up with all these challenges. And so I remember being, and to point that point out, I was at a Super Bowl one time, and you have the pools. It was 4 seconds to go to the half. And I had the $100 pool for the half. It was mine because there was only 4 seconds to go. The Oakland Raiders had 96 yards to go for a touchdown, and that wasn't going to happen in 4 seconds. Instead, what happened, the jackass fades back, throws a side pass out here, somebody intercepts it and scores a touchdown, and then kicks. The whole, everything blew up. You know, the whole thing just absolutely blew up in front of my eyes, and I'm really pissed. You know, I'm walking around there all bummed out. Well, the end of the game came, and the amount was $250 if you had the right score. I had the right score. I got the $250 on account of that guy doing that. Now, that isn't how fast my higher power usually works, but that's the way he put it. You know, you think things are not good, then things will happen that'll, you know, down the road, and it happens all the time. And so now I've trained myself to the point where if something fantastic happens, I trace it back, you know, to something that was negative, that I thought was negative, that participated in this happening. And it happens all the time. You know, so that was what really solidified ultimately my belief that there was a higher power. I don't believe there's any coincidences. I got to the point where with this sponsor that I had, who had come in the same way I did in his belief of a higher power, he'd come in the same way, but he had converted over. And so for a long time, I mean, really probably too long, I just still denied that there was such a thing, still denied that there was a power greater than me. But so one day he got a hold of me and he said, "I want you to go." I said, "Are there guys out in your meeting that you admire?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I want you to take 5 of them. Pick 5, go out there, and talk to them. find out what it is you admire about him. I said, okay. So I went out there. I had five guys all picked out. Every one of them had a light in their eye, and they were having fun, and they were doing all this, you know, doing that, neat guys. And I would talk to them and say, well, you know, and every single one of them, every one of them had a power greater than themselves, always at the bottom. Always at the bottom, they had a power greater than themselves in their life. And I started thinking, well, maybe all this stuff that's been happening to me isn't just coincidences. Maybe not. Maybe there's more to it than that. And then I began to think about things. I thought about stupid things. You know, my mind works really weird. I thought about sky. Is there an end? Isn't there an end to that somewhere? Isn't there an end to the sky? No, I guess not. It just goes forever. My mind can't contemplate forever, you know, in that kind of space. So there's something more, way, way, way more powerful than I am. And it's been, and that power has been working in my life since I can remember, if I really look at it. If I can remember, far back as I can remember, that higher power has been working on my behalf. And I did not know it. Well, it took me a while to grasp that. It took me a while to think it all over and go all over. I can't physically show you a picture of that power. I never had lunch with it. But I just know that there is a power that's looking over everything that happens. You know, everything that happens somehow. This whole universe is happening. And it always seems like all my challenges get taken care of. And I've had challenge after challenge after challenge that are not big. You would say, well, those aren't really bad challenges. Well, they wake me up. They keep me up sometimes. Sometimes I'm awake all night thinking about some dumb thing, you know, or so how to fix some dumb thing, you know, and it always gets fixed better than I would fix it. Always. Always gets fixed better. Always comes out better than I would have it come out because I'm so limited in my mind as to where I can go with any kind of challenge in my life. So anyway, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous or nearly new, please, please, please come in with an open mind. Another thing I want to talk about too to people that are new or fairly new is the idea that when I got here, one of the things that happened when I first got here is I would hang around with these guys that had 2 weeks more than I did or 3 weeks more than I did. And we'd be buddies, everything's going along cool, and then, pow, they'd disappear. And say, well, I'd ask somebody, what happened to old Harry over there? Oh, he went out. I went out, you know, and then a month later, 2 months later, Harry walks in the door. And I would be the first guy to attack him, say, hey, listen, you knew more than I know about this. You know more than I know about this. And you went out. What participated that? What led to that? And so they would sit down and talk to you, and they would say, well, here's how it would go. Well, my wife said this or said that or did this, you know, or my boss made me go do this and go that. And at the bottom of the list, and then, oh, by the way, I quit going to meetings. Oh, by the way. And that oh, by the way got my attention because I heard it every time. Every time, oh, by the way, I quit going to meetings. Because I'm talking to guys that are new, and I didn't realize it. I wasn't talking to old-timers. And so I began to realize that, hey, you can't stop going to meetings if you're new or nearly new. Do not. I don't like to give out that kind of stuff, but do not quit going to meetings. I've seen too many of them die. Because they quit going to meetings specifically. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has paved the way for so many people, so many miracles that I've seen happen in lives and just life. Life in general. Life in general has taken me to a point where I've got time now. That doesn't mean anything. It only means that I've got today. To me, the most important birthday is the number one. That's the hardest one to get. The hardest one to get, the hardest one to keep. When you get after a certain point, it's like, no matter what happens in these in these challenges that I have, the answer is never a drink. I don't even think about a drink. I might kill somebody, but I'm not going to drink. You know, I mean, if I, that's the whole thing. I could get so mad that I could do a lot of things, but drinking, isn't it? For some reason, over a period of time, and because of good, I believe a good sponsor, he was tough, but he was a marshmallow inside. I didn't tell you, I got to tell you about the fourth step. First thing he did one time, he said, you got to write out, when I first asked him to sponsor me, he said, you got to write out the steps, write them all out, and then we sit down and talk about them. And immediately in my mind, when he said, write them out, I didn't think I was a writer. Actually, what I do is writing. But he said, you got to write them out, and I thought, oh, no. And for a split second, I don't know if you guys but have it, I know you do, for a split second, here's what went through my mind in a split second when he said, you have to write them out. My mind took me back to journalism class in high school. My father, the town we lived in, my father was a journalist in the town. And the journalism teacher knew my father, knew him well, and he expected great things out of me. And I did not believe that I could write. I just didn't have any idea that I could write. So when the school final came in that class, you had to write out a story. And he told you how many sentences and all this stuff that had to be in it. So I went down to the library, got a book called Bill Stern's Short Stories, Sports Stories, and I found a story that fit it perfectly, right down to the, you know, letter, practically in terms of paragraphs and all this stuff. So I changed the entire story. You know, I changed it to the names, the places, the dates. All that stuff totally changed this thing and turned it in. And I'll never forget the next day after all this was done, after all the papers were turned in, the teacher says, we got a lot of, oh, and then they told me, they said, you know, we're going to put the best short story that from this class is going in the high school annual. And so he says the next day, he says, we've got a special one here I want to read you from James. He called me James, you know. We've got a special story here. And my buddies were sitting next to me, and they started reading that story, and he punched me. He goes, you didn't write that. And I said, no, yeah, you're kidding me. You know? And so he says that this is a real special story. And so I didn't want my father to see it. I was afraid it was going to go in the high school annual. My father would see it because he'd know I didn't write that. So then the next day, the teacher comes in and he says, Reader's Digest has an annual contest for best short story in America. And I mean, now I can see my short stories going to you know, in the Reader's Digest. You know, I'm projecting this whole thing. And Reader's Digest is going to have the plagiarized story by me of Bill Stern, and I could see Bill Stern knocking on my door. You know, all this stuff happened in just 1 second. It flew through my mind in a split second, you know, that would happen. Well, that's not what happened, you know, so, you know, obviously. But anyway, it's amazing how it could work. So when we got through the steps, and I really had to brush through the third step. It was very tough because I had to write it for him, but I had to do it in such a way, I didn't have any belief then in a higher power. I had to do it in such a way that he'd buy it, you know, let me go on. So he let me go on to the fourth step, and I wrote it, and he was the guy, was the racetrack guy. Remember, I already told you, I saw him out there, the same guy. So he said, come on, we're going to Del Mar, and you're going to do your fifth step on the way down there. Now, I had labored on this story, on this step, for a long time. I was the type of guy, the only way you could get me to do it is when I felt my back to the wall. Then I would sit down and write, you know, maybe two or three pages. And then I wouldn't do it again for a long time. And then I'd get in some trouble somehow, and I'm back to the wall, write, until I finally got it finished. So I knew that when this guy read it, I was done with him. He's going to say, you're a scumbag. You know, this is the worst thing I ever heard in my entire life. And so we're on our way down there, and I begin to read it to him, and I didn't. And I'd read it over 20 times before I was reading it to him, and I didn't get anything out of it. But as I'm reading it to him, all of a sudden the in-between lines started to fill in, and I could see my life as the way it had gone on in between those lines. So anyway, I got all, finally got all finished, and he looks at me, and he said, "You think that's pretty bad crap, don't you?" I said, "Well, yeah." And he said, "How would you like to live with the fact you choked a man to death?" Man, whew. Well, I'll never forget that feeling when he said that. I went, "Oh, my God." I never asked him no more about that, and he never told me no more about that. But it took the wind out of me. It took the wind right out of me. It also made me realize that my story is just nothing, just a bag of nothing compared to other people's, especially compared to his. I never did hear that part of the story. I didn't want to. I mean, you know, he was a good guy for me at the time. But anyway, I never did hear the end of it. And so anyway, he ended up being not just a, like most sponsees end up being more than just friends. All right, they become, I have one sponsee that's taken 50 years on the 4th of July, who's going to be up at the convention in wherever it is. He's going to be up there to take it. He wants me to go up there and give him a chip, which would be a hell of a deal. I call him my oldest living sponsee. You know, he does not like that term. He's not the oldest sponsee, but he's the oldest living sponsee. I mean, I've got other sponsors that are older than him, and not sobriety-wise, but older in age. So he makes it, he says, "You make it sound like I'm the oldest guy in the," you know, this guy gives me crap all the time. But for 50 years we've been together, coming this January. Another guy that I live in the same complex with us now is my very, very best friend. He just took 47 years, and we've been together every minute of that time. And then I've got a few others that are in the 40s that are heading for 50. This is a beautiful program. This is a beautiful program. This is where we not only gather friends, they become brothers and sisters, as far as I'm concerned. Those guys are my brothers. I have a brother that I really dearly love, my brother. But he doesn't know me like these guys know me. He doesn't know my life. He's not an alcoholic. He's never sat down and listened to, you know, what my story is. He were friends, and I would tell him, but he wouldn't understand because he's not alcoholic. So anyway, if you're alcoholic, you're in the right place. You're in the if you're in here today. You're in Alcoholics Anonymous is made up, you know, of men and women who have found it necessary to get rid of the urge to drink alcohol and they want to be of service. And you know, I don't like every single person in AA, but I'll tell you what, there's not one person that I know of, if they would call me at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, "I'm about to have a drink, would you come down and have coffee with me?" I would go. I don't care. You know, I would go just because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had one sponsor call me one night, and it took 12 o'clock at night, and this isn't that long ago. And he said, "I have a jar of pills in one hand and I've got a bottle of gin in the other." And I said, "Where are you?" And he hung up. Now, this guy had done a great job, I thought, up to that point. I thought he was doing great. I was the last person he ever talked to. Broke my heart. I have another buddy that my wife and I went with him to the Kentucky Derby 2 years ago, when that $180 horse hit. And we had a fabulous time for a week with him. He had told me, he was a big horse guy too, so he said, "Let's go to the Derby. This is early in the year. Let's go to the Kentucky Derby." And I said, "Okay, you know." So so my wife and we decide, okay, we're going. So you buy the tickets. You have to buy them for 2 days. You have to buy Kentucky Oaks and the Kentucky Derby different days, but you have to buy tickets for both days. We're on the plane. My wife got big hats on and everything, and everybody knows where we're going. Everybody knows, "Hey, where are you going? Kentucky Derby?" "Yeah, we're going to the Derby." And this guy, this my sponsor, he was from Kentucky, from Louisville, Kentucky, and he told me, he said, "We're going to stay at Mom's house." I didn't know what Mom's house meant. I didn't ask him. And he set this whole thing up, and it was all paid. You know, the tickets were expensive, but I didn't pay much attention to it because we were going to the Derby. And so anyway, we heard somebody on the plane say, all on my ticket, all the food and drinks at the Derby are free. And I went, well, I don't see that on my, I don't know about that. Well, we get out there to the Derby, the day before the Derby, the Oaks, and sure enough, everything's free. Everything's free for eating and drinking. These guys are walking around with mint juleps in the tray, and you just go up and pick up a mint julep, you know, it's for free. I was watching this one guy, and he had this humongous thing of mint juleps, and the next day, the first day, I was watching him, and everybody tipped him. You know, everybody gave him a tip. I mean, it's a free drink, and the food was free. My wife was going over to get all the free, she was going over to get the free food and bringing it back to where we were. So anyway, this guy, when we got, we flew into, what time is it? I got.
Almost done.
Okay, I'll finish this story real quick. He said, we got to Kentucky, and it was pouring rain, and we get in this cab, and we're going out to Mom's house. And I kept looking up in there, I could barely see. All of a sudden, we were getting closer, and I could see it's all this green. I looked like I was in Georgia. There's big mansions. And then my buddy says, turn left here, right here. And we had just gone by this humongous mansion. Here's this another, his house is a humongous mansion. And I just said to him, I said, you know, Mom's house. And he started laughing because he knew what I was thinking. And he says to me, see that house next door? I said, yeah, that's Papa John's house. And so when Lynn and I got up into our little suite that we had, we were there for a week. And when I saw the suite, I said, I'll see you next Monday, you know, when we were going back to hell with the Derby. So anyway, he said, yeah. So we look up Papa John. And it says, Papa John owns the most expensive home in Louisville, Kentucky, worth an estimated $11 million. And that's Louisville, Kentucky. And so her house is the same. It's next door. It's in the same, it's the exact same thing. I mean, we had the time of our life there. And his mother, I'd met her many times before. And as we're leaving, this great weekend we had together with him, his mother, she said to me, take care of my boy. She put her arms around me and she said, take care of my boy. So this last year, this is where we came back, and this last year, all of a sudden I get a call from his work one day. He's just working in recovery, working in the financial department, highly, highly rated, wouldn't fire him for anything. And this guy says, have you seen Mark? And I said, no. He said, well, we can't find him. And I said, oh, shit. And so they started looking all around, and finally in Huntington Beach, they found him in a parking lot, sitting in the car, dead, drinking. I would have never, ever in a million years thought that. Broke my heart, because he's one of my best friends, not just my best friends, but somebody that Alcoholics Anonymous needed. So please, all of you, stay alive, stay well, stay happy. Stay happy, and I just want to leave you with the idea that I know, believe anyway, for all of you, what I know for me, and that is that none of you have had your best day yet. That's number one. And number two, I am trying to be the man today that my dog thinks I am. Thank you.